Hello, and welcome to this fortnight's edition of the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell, and I'm a political journalist. And I am joined by Nick Dennis from the Tory Workers Group. Is that right, Nick?
Yes, that's right. Thank you. Hello, Emma.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, when I say I'm not too bad, I'm obviously miserably depressed about everything Conservative. But apart from that, I'm doing very well.
Apart from that, all cheery. And I'm also, of course, joined by Mark Thompson, who is a recovering Lib Dem. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, thanks. I'm a bit depressed, but that's because it's just been the state of the union. And, you know, it just kind of reminds me that Donald Trump's president of the United States, and he's only been president for a year. He's got at least another 3 years, and it might even be another 7 years. So I'm not feeling too good about that. But apart from that, I'm doing okay.
Well, this is going to be a scary lesson, isn't it?
It's going to be amazing. I've got chocolate. I'm eating chocolate, so that's making me a bit happy.
Good for you.
Well, you know, as a fat girl, Nick, I can tell you, it doesn't work.
I don't know. You seem very cheery, Emma. So anyway, we'll see. I'll let you know. I'll let you know later how it works.
Fair enough. So just to really cheer you up, I thought we could start this week's discussion with the latest Brexit shenanigans. Woo! So Brexit, three different scenarios, each one more disastrous than the last. And this has been leaked, so we're not supposed to know how disastrous Brexit is going to be as the general public. And as a result of people sort of waking up to the fact that Brexit might be a disaster, it turns out that Theresa May is not gung-ho enough and therefore is once again in peril. Must be a Tuesday. Nick.
Well, I'll
tell us how your party is feeling.
Well, first of all, I'll before I go on to that, I will talk about the leak of the stats that we had this week. My view on the leak of the stats is they just don't matter. It's pointless. It doesn't matter because when we had the referendum, the majority of the country voted for Brexit. And at the time, there were lots of people saying there's going to be economic crisis or it's going to be bad for the economy. And essentially, a majority either didn't believe them or chose to ignore them. So ultimately, the releasing of the stats, I mean, who knows? Who cares in a way? I mean, we're having Brexit. We've got to deliver Brexit, which is an extremely complicated and boring but important process. So ultimately, whether Brexit is good or not, or whether it harms the economy or not, it, to be honest, is completely irrelevant.
Well, I think completely irrelevant is a slightly weird take on the importance of the economy to the centrality of our society. And also, as we know, we don't know what Brexit means or what people voted for. So given that the three options that are laid out are all Brexit, they could all be considered Brexit. Doesn't it matter quite a lot that we know which is the least harmful?
Mean, what was on the ballot paper was to leave the European Union and the institutions of the European Union. That ultimately is what people voted for. Obviously, there are many reasons underneath that. But beyond that, I think essentially there's probably a very narrow window of what the EU will tolerate and what we will want. And again, like last time, we've got this sort of little drama. I mean, the EU always loves drama in its negotiations. They've released their positions. The UK have talked about their positions. And what's going to happen is we're going to have 4 or 5 months of basically drama, arguing, and in the end, they're going to come up with a final last-minute deal like last time, which you could have predicted right now. So, you know, the Brexit vote was to leave the European Union. Beyond that, there's a very sort of narrow gap in terms of what both sides want. So, you know, I think it's all just basically a bit of drama, really.
But I mean, it's not a bit of drama, is it? It's, are we in or out of the customs union? Are we in or out of the single market? No, These are quite fundamental and important decisions.
Because we're leaving the EU. It's very simple.
But we don't have to be out of both of them. It's not that simple. And that's why there are these options on the table. That's why there are these options on the paper.
We have to leave the single market and we have to leave the customs union. And yes, we need to create a deal, you know, a new trade deal, a new deal of how to, you know, operate with the EU. But ultimately, we're leaving the institutions of the European Union. So those things aren't even on the table.
But they, I mean, that's just denying the reality of the fact that they are a possibility. They're very much the European open to that being a possibility. We're open to that being a possibility. Some people on the far right and the far left are not open to that as a possibility, but they are within our negotiating grasp.
Emma, even I hate to break it to you, but you're the one who's denying reality. The vote to leave the EU was to leave the EU, and that means leaving the customs union and leaving the single market.
But that's not what was said either in the campaign or on the ballot paper.
If you don't leave the single market and the customs union, you're not leaving the EU.
But you're leaving the EU. You're just not leaving those parts of it. I mean, there are other countries outside of the EU that have opted into the single market. Yeah, I mean,
we're not going to do what Norway's done. I mean, basically, we're going to leave the.
You're saying it's not even an option, but Norway is clearly an option.
I don't think realistically is an option, though. It's not, you know, I mean, what we'll do is we're going to leave the European Union and then we're going to negotiate a new deal with the European Union. And I hate to say it, but I think Jeremy Corbyn's probably got the right phrasing in this. We probably will have a customs union with the European Union, but it won't be the customs union. And we will obviously have trading deals with the European Union, but it won't be the single market. What's going to be interesting is how close, it is to all these things. But I mean, the European Union aren't going to allow us to stay in the single market in the customs unions anyway if we don't if we don't use the European Court of Justice and we don't accept freedom of movement. That's another reason why it's off the table.
But as I say, these are not off the table. They're off the table as far as the internal politics of the Conservative Party are concerned, but they're not off the negotiating table. And
well, Labour has the same position. Labour also.
They do. Yeah. Labour have been utterly useless on Brexit. I'm not going to stand there and defend Labour's position on Brexit. On Brexit, it's quite interesting because I think Labour have had an inverse Blairite thing where
sounds
the
painful, Emma.
People being most pragmatically close to the country, as it were, have been the leadership where they've kind of blethered around. And actually, they're going against their own membership in order to win a wider poll of votes, which is basically the Blair model. It's quite extraordinary that this is supposed to be, you know, the new empowering leadership of the Labour Party doing what the members want. 75% of the members want Labour to stand up and say, no, hang on, we don't want to leave the customs union. We don't want to leave the single market. We should be a party that is as close to Remain as is humanly possible. So it's extraordinary, actually, in terms of Labour politics, that what Corbyn has done is taken an astonishingly Blairite tactic and turn it on his own members. And at the moment, he's popular enough to be allowed to do that. Mark, you're the neutral party in this in terms of, I mean, I don't think you're particularly neutral on the referendum, but in terms of the sort of left-right politics, how do you see this progressing?
Well, to an extent, I agree with what Nick's just said, but I'm going to qualify it Nick's sort of describing it almost as if it's a fait accompli and it's obvious that that's what the country voted for. I don't think it is obvious that that's what the country voted for. People like Nigel Farage were going around just before the referendum when he thought he wasn't going to win it and he was trying to win over kind of wavering potential people who might vote leave. He was talking about Norway and he was saying, what's so bad about Norway? We could have the Norway option. So it's not like there was a very, very clear thing that people were voting for. However, what has happened post the referendum is that the goalposts have been shifted quite significantly. And I think the political reality is that we will end up leaving the single market and we will end up leaving the customs union. But I do think there will be some kind of bureaucratic bodge to allow us to have things like not having to have a hard border in Northern Ireland, which is that's like a huge issue. And they're going to have to do something about that. And at the moment, I can't quite see exactly how that plays out, but they're definitely going to have to do something. We can't just completely leave the EU and also expect to still have a soft border or, you know, no border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the EU. That's just not possible. But coming to the original question, which is about the leak of this paper. I mean, I wrote a blog post. The first blog post I've written about politics in over a year, because I felt like I had something I needed to say about this. And it is that basically it really won't matter at all. It won't have any political cut through because partly for the reasons that Nick's just said, you know, that things were said before the referendum and people ignored them or didn't believe them. But also because even the tack I took with the blog post that I wrote was, let's just look at, even if people do believe it, what effect is it going to have? And I actually did some maths. I like doing a bit of maths. And if you look at what GDP was in 2016 and you look at how much GDP had grown from the year before, it was 1.8%. Now, if you extrapolate that forward 15 years and then you work out what GDP would be in 2031 on that basis, and then you take off, let's say, the midpoint of between the minus 2 and the minus 8% that was in the paper, they were saying, you know, we'd be worse off between 2% and 8%. Well, let's take 5%. Let's take the midpoint. So we'd be 5% worse off. And then you work back and work out what that would mean for GDP growth over the 15 years. It would go down from 1.8 to 1.53%. Now, realistically, who's going to notice that? Who even listens when they watch the news? No, I'm not factoring any recessions in. I'm just saying, if we just extrapolate, if we just pretend. Yeah. I did say in the blog post, it's a rough calculation. It's pretty rough. But I'm just saying, if we go from where we are now, where we're in 2016,
but Mark,
to where we'd be in 2031, it's going to make a difference of about 0.3% on average per year. Most people will never even notice that, because most people don't even pay attention to what those figures are. It won't mean anything. What it will mean in reality, if that was to happen, is that the country will be worse off by about £1,500
per person. Another interesting stat, which sort of complements what you're saying, Mark, is
that no one will,
I remember sort of soon
that.
After the referendum, they YouGov, I think, did a survey where they asked people, do you think Brexit will have, you know, a short or mid-term negative economic impact on the UK? And I think about 40% said yes. And then they asked the people, do you think Brexit will have a negative, Brexit media, you know, in the short or medium term, will have a negative impact on your own personal finances? And I think only about 18% said yes. And I think that sort of goes to the heart of one of the big problems that we have currently in our society. I think people don't really feel connected to the bigger growth, shall we say, that, you know, I think people don't feel connected to, you know, the GDP stats or, you know, are we working together as a country? So and I think that fueled a lot of the Brexit vote, where people basically, when economists said, oh, well, you know, as a country, you'll get poorer. People said, well, what that means is the bankers will get a bit poorer, but it doesn't affect me because I've not got richer for ages.
No, I think that's right. And I think Mark's right that it's very difficult to understand a negative, understand £1,500 a year that you never did have, if you see what I mean.
Exactly. That's the problem, because it's potential growth that could happen in the future that then doesn't happen. I mean, people just simply don't feel that. It's not, you can't touch it, you can't taste it. It's not there. It was never there. So,
I agree that it doesn't have coinage in the country. I think there does seem to be a certain amount of shifting in terms of how people are feeling about the final deal. I think there's been quite a lot of polling recently that's shown certain nervousness about what the final deal would be. And there was a minister in the House of Commons today, as we record this on Wednesday, the 31st of January, who has been reprimanded for saying, well, hang on, maybe we should have a look at this and listen to the experts. And do analysis and act on it, which is
that's Dr. Philip Lee. He used to be my MP in Bracknell, and I've met him, and he's a really, really good bloke, really, really good local MP. He helped me out with a couple of things, and I think it's pretty disgraceful the way he's been treated, because all he's saying is what is common sense, and yet he's been reprimanded apparently by his party, and apparently Theresa May and her team are furious with him. All he's done is state a fact. And yet the minister that stood up at the dispatch box and introduced the civil service and said that they always get things wrong. Oh, he's fine. That's fine to do that. I mean, it's not fine to point out that we might want to be a little bit careful about what we're getting the country into.
Tackling Brexit to one side, which obviously I think Brexit's a terrible idea, but I think it probably is going to happen. When I'm talking about what's on or off the table, Nick, I'm not saying what I think we're going to end up with. I think we've got a dreadful negotiating team. We're going to end up with a shitey deal. So I think you're probably right. They're not going to put stuff that should be on the table on the table. That doesn't mean that it is theoretically not on the table. So that's where I was coming at on that. But putting Brexit to one side, I think one of the big problems we've got in our politics at the moment, and this is not a partisan point, but it is that, you know, that traducing of expertise, that, you know, oh, the experts know nothing, this populism on the left and the right that is being used to stoke up some quite nasty feelings across the board. And I just think it's such short-term strategy for getting yourself out of a hole you've dug yourself into.
So is what you're saying, Emma, that everyone, no one should be on the left or right and everyone should be a centrist? Because I agree.
No, I know. I think there are perfectly valid arguments and perfectly good differences that Nick and I might have over capitalism and the role of the state in life. That does not mean that what we, and actually running down the middle, you just get run over from both sides, blah, blah, blah. But it's more about the traducing of the people who are going to help either side. The civil service is going to be there implementing whatever the government tells it to implement. If the government tells it to implement stupid things, it will try to do it in the best possible way, but it has to implement the stupid things. It's not the civil service being stupid. So it's really dangerous when we traduce these institutions. And it's the same with some of the way that we talk about public services. It's the way we talk about the police, the way that some people talk about teachers. And I mean, I remember reading a really interesting article just after the election about one of the big problems the Tories have. And in it, someone who was having a conversation at a polling station with a neighbour or something said, "And so who are you voting? Are you going to vote Tory?" And she said, "No, I'm a nurse." Mm. And that was all she felt she needed to say, because as far as she was concerned, Tories were anti-nurse. And the more that rhetoric is fed, the harder that relationship becomes in the longer term. Mm. And, you know, that is equally true of most teachers I meet, particularly post-Gove. You know, the way that Gove, whatever you think of his educational reforms, and, you know, again, Nick and I might disagree on that, the way that Gove and his team talked about the blob was so disrespectful to the profession that you were never going to get them to accept and understand and work with your ideas. Speaking as a conservative, it does engage
with trade unions and trade unions quite a lot. It's you know, I understand completely what you're talking about, but from the opposite direction, trying to sort of start off in a neutral or evidence-based conversation with some people is almost impossible. But just sort of take what you're saying and give a slightly different angle to it. I voted Remain, and one of the main reasons I voted Remain, because with the European Union, I could see the arguments both ways, and I was not too passionate either way, to be honest or not. And what I find really interesting now is the country essentially is living what I've had to live for the last 6 or 7 years, which is constant, being in the Tory party, constant discussions about the European Union and arguments where people can't prove it either way. They just have the same arguments all the time. And so I, you know, in some ways it feels quite cathartic that the whole country is now suffering what I've had to suffer for the last 6 or 7 years. But one of the reasons I voted Remain is because I knew how complicated and difficult and fractious the process of Brexit would be. And I knew how that would essentially just suck all the energy within the civil service, suck all the news energy. And what it would do is in my opinion, stop the government from being able to deal with the stuff that's really, really even more important than Brexit, which is, you know, we're going to talk about housing later, which is, you know, how to, you know, increase productivity and harness new technology so it works for all people. It is about improving education. And these are all things that actually, I think, to be honest, are more important than Brexit. But the government and the Conservative Party, unfortunately, is carrying the can on this, can't deal with any of these issues properly, or chooses not to, which means, you know, nurses and teachers who are working in ever worse conditions, obviously are taking it out on us. And I think that's really sad. But that's just what's happening.
What I find very paradoxical, and I think it maybe is slightly tangential to your point, Nick, but maybe kind of goes with the grain of it. And I live in the countryside now, and I know, you know, lots of people around where I live who voted Leave. And I've talked to some of them about the reasons for it. And I also kind of know from previous discussions the view of things like the government. And it seems very strange to me that the exact same people who really, really don't rate the government and think that all politicians are, you know, this, that and the other and wouldn't trust them as far as you can throw them, are willing to vote Leave and therefore put in the hands of this generation of British politicians the biggest decision that's been taken since the Second World War about the future of the country. And just, you know, once that binary decision's been taken, just let the politicians get on with it. It seems very strange to me that they then wouldn't want, because I don't think anyone around here who voted Leave would want the second referendum. They consider that that decision's been made. But in terms of the exact nature of the deal, it's almost like shrug and just let them get on with it, even though ordinarily they wouldn't trust them. I find that very odd.
Yeah, and the reality of excitement is some of the work that I do is around you know, the implementation of Brexit basically as well, and you know, it doesn't matter what you believe. It is a really hard, difficult thing, which is really time consuming and seriously frustrating and very boring, a lot of it. I just noticed today that the government have extended like their fast track schemes. All the people who didn't get on but got close are now being accepted on because they need people to basically go into the you know, the Department of Exiting the European Union to do more work, and it's true, and it's not, you know, this is, and no matter what you might say, well, that's a reason for leaving, the fact that we're so intertwined with how the European Union works or not, but the truth of the matter is this is going to be a painful, long exercise. It's going to take so much time, and basically while this is happening, government is not going to be able to deal with other stuff which is actually probably more important. I find that very sad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think this comes back to some of the stuff that we've been saying over the last few episodes. You know, the government, for a combination of reasons, largely it's almost completely taken up with Brexit, and secondly, it doesn't really have a very big majority, is actually unable to kind of do anything of any sort of major legislative impact. And that's making a lot of people very antsy, because, you know, Theresa May needs something big. She needs a big rabbit out of a big hat, and she has neither rabbit nor hat at the moment.
No, she doesn't. And I think it feeds into your original point, Emma, because what you're left with is basically people shouting each other louder and louder and more insults, and people, and then ultimately people being unhappy because problems aren't being dealt with properly, and then so this leads to this like really sort of nasty environment that we have actually. Partly as well, because, you know, there's nothing that people aren't able to do stuff or deal with stuff that's being done, so it becomes personal.
And it just seems like every time you think, oh well, they've got to let her get to the end of Brexit, there just seems to be another May wobble and another kind of round of will she still be here next week, and that just, it's not good for the country, it's not good for the Conservative Party, it's not good for Parliament, it's not good for government. It just feels like we're in this permanent state of teetering on the edge. I mean, you know, Nick, how many letters do you reckon are in now?
I think if the party could see some form of alternative, I think there'd be 100 letters arriving tomorrow at Graham Brady's door. I think there's very
talk
essentially
us through, for those listeners who don't know the process. Talk us through. Process.
Well, I don't know in complete detail, but essentially, if I think it's 15% of the parliamentary party send a letter to Graham Brady, who's the chair of the 1922 committee, which is basically, I suppose, that sort of trade union for Tory MPs, then a vote of confidence or no confidence is called in the Prime Minister. So that's what Ian Duncan Smith faced, basically. And so if that was to happen, then every single MP would get to vote on whether they have confidence or not in Theresa May. And she would probably lose such a vote at the moment in time. But, I mean, the big problem is, though, people, you know, I mean, well, for a start, you know, having a leadership contest could rip the party apart, like very seriously. Yeah. Not having a leadership contest could also rip the party apart, because we didn't have one last time. And so the members would be very angry about it. Having a leadership contest, which will take maybe 2 to 3 months during this period of things are happening, obviously is not, you know, the clock is ticking, Article 50 clock is ticking. But also at the same time as well, you know, who wants to become leader and carry the can for this stuff as well, because we've described the situation. Who really wants to become leader in this situation? So there is a lot of dissatisfaction. And what you see is what you had this week, for example, where Nick Bowles, Nicholas Soames and Rob Halfen wrote a joint article in The Sun saying, you know, that Theresa May's got to focus on the domestic agenda, be radical on housing and the NHS and education. And so what Tory MPs are trying to do, really, is they're trying to push the Prime Minister to be more radical on the domestic agenda. But unfortunately, because of partly time taken up with Brexit, fear of Parliament, the small parliamentary majority, and I don't know other reasons, but it's not happening. So unfortunately, I think we're going to have this merry-go-round for the rest of the year, very unsatisfactorily.
And it's only January.
So yeah, I might be Mark, wrong. Tell me I'm wrong.
If you are a Tory MP, tell me I'm wrong. What would you do?
If I was,
what? If you were a backbench Tory MP, Mark, what would you do?
I'm not sure there is anyone who could unite the party. I mean, Theresa May is struggling. She certainly can't lead the Tories into the next election. I mean, that election campaign was just absolutely catastrophic. And the fact that she's saying that she intends to lead the Tories in 2022, well, that's what leaders say, isn't it? They have to say that. Otherwise, the clock begins ticking and you end up in a situation like Blair was, where everyone's manoeuvring because they know he's not going to be around.
There? But
I think if I was a backbench Tory MP, I wouldn't do anything right now. I think they have to wait until we are out of the European Union, or at least we get to the end of the Article 50 period, because I just think a 3-month, 4-month internal election campaign whilst the country is rudderless, I just think would look absolutely dreadful and would look so navel-gazing and narcissistic on behalf of the party that I just can't see how they could do it. So I think they are stuck with her. But come April next year, I think it's all over for her then. I think the letters will go in if she doesn't go voluntarily.
I mean, to play devil's advocate slightly, I can speak from experience that you can get over having a massive internal navel-gazing session straight after the country's made a disastrous decision, because look at what happened to Labour. My thing about the Tories at the moment, I don't know what I would do, because I'm not entirely sure. Yeah, the worry is that you have a leadership contest and then all anyone talks about is the Tory leadership contest for 3 months. But all anyone's talking about at the moment is the Tory leadership contest. I'm not entirely sure how Boris Johnson could piss any more inside the tent, whilst also being paid for the privilege by having a very high-profile cabinet
Boris Johnson. My cheeky theory is that he actually wants to get sacked with dignity so he can go back to writing for the Daily Telegraph and earn 3 times the money for doing half the amount of work. He tried at party conference to get sacked for another reason, and it failed, and I find it hilarious that he's basically doing everything he can to be sacked and it doesn't work. I mean, what he needs to do is he needs to fly off to Israel without telling everybody and meet the Prime Minister over there, and then that'll probably get him sacked. But
to be fair, though, he is at least the Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, no, it's easy. He probably can get away with it. I mean, if you ask me, hand on heart, and this is a controversial opinion, if Theresa May were to go, I would actually back Boris to be leader, because ultimately Brexit's happening, so the people who really believed in it have got to be given a chance to deliver what they believe to be a great thing. And I think, I've come to the conclusion now that as Brexit's happening, what we need is if Theresa May was to go, we actually need a leading Brexiteer, and he is probably the leading Brexiteer to quote Angela Rayne, shit or bust.
Nick, the problem is, though, that Boris Johnson isn't really a Brexiter. He just did it because he thought it was the quickest way to become Prime Minister. If you want an actual Brexiter, you need someone like Michael Gove, who actually genuinely, passionately believes in leaving the EU. When he was a minister, all the stuff that happened when he was a minister, he kept finding himself, according to his own testimony, blocked by EU rules, and he came to the conclusion that we needed to leave. So he's the one that you want. Unfortunately, I don't think he'd make a very good Prime Minister. I don't think Boris Johnson would either, for completely different reasons. Just coming back to your question, Emma, when you were talking about, how can the Tory party carry on like this? Well, I'm reminded back in 1995. Do you remember when John Major strode to the podium and insisted that everyone needed to put up or shut up and, put himself forward as a candidate for the leadership. And John Redwood then threw his hat into the ring and ran against him and major trounced him. Right? Well, the thing that I remember most about that was me thinking, now I am very into politics and I have always been, but there was a period of maybe 2 or 3 years when I was at university, 92 and 95, when I wasn't paying that much attention. Mm. I wasn't paying as much attention anyway. And I remember when he did that thinking, what's he doing? What, he's prime minister? What's he on about? I didn't really know what he was talking about. I didn't know about all of this backbiting that was going on. And I think that's the closest I can get in my adult lifetime to someone who doesn't pay that much attention to politics. I bet you 90-odd% of the country aren't even really aware that there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes. I think you'd be astonished at how far the Tory party can limp on in its current state without actually having to do anything. I think it can go on for a very, very long time.
I think it can go on to the next election. But if you look at the damage that was done by Major limping on to the Tory party.
They're two different things, though. Yes, I agree. There was a lot of damage done, but they could still carry on.
But I think also the problem is, Mark's correct, and you're correct as well, Emma, but also what that means is we have a government that's not able to, you know, strategically look and deal with the issues of the NHS, come up with a new system to replace, obviously, the sort of outsourcing private public service model that's failing now, you know, deal with tuition fees. And so people might not notice the Tory party limping on, but I think what they are going to do is they're going to grumble more and more about essentially things not working as well as they could do.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you're absolutely right, Mark, that people don't pay as much attention to politics as we do. Although I do think we are living in more political times. I think that's, it feels like more people are paying attention than it did in the 90s. But I don't think it just matters what the public think. I think it also matters what a government's able to do. And that's absolutely where Nick is right, that, you know, this is, they are not able to currently do very much at all. I think we've probably, I mean, Nick, I suspect we'll revisit this public grief of yours over the weeks.
I hope not, but I think you're right.
So I think maybe we should draw a discreet veil over the troubles of the Tory party, or at least the internal troubles of the Tory party for now, and go on to our second topic, which is numbers out today, which say that the number of social housing properties in England have dropped 11% in a year. Now, obviously, this is something that I'm very passionate about. Social housing's been on my agenda for the longest possible time. I remember I was working in social housing in 2011 when Grant Shapps, was it 20? It might have been 2010, the first budget or the first spring statement. I can't remember which one it was, but they cut the social housing budget by 63%. And I tweeted at Grant Shapps angrily about this, and he said to me, "You can judge me on how many more social houses are built under this government than the last." And I would just like to say, Grant Shapps, if you're listening, I do. Mark, housing, you're our voice of rural communities. Is social housing a big issue out there, or is this just an urban thing?
I mean, I'm not really involved in politics around here, to be fair, so I don't really know the answer to that question as fully as I would have done where I used to live, where I was involved in the local Lib Dems. However, I don't think it's a major issue. The bigger issue in this area is whenever a developer wants to build some houses, immediately protest groups spring up and claim that it's spoiling the view and coming up with all kinds of reasons why it shouldn't be built in this area. And the people who are protesting claim, "We're very happy for new houses to be built, just not here. They need to just be built somewhere else." And everywhere that houses want to be built, that happens. And I find that very, very short-sighted, that kind of NIMBYism, because the same people who join protest groups to prevent houses being built are the exact same people who then complain that their children can't buy houses where they grew up, and their children end up moving away. And it's very, very hypocritical. But 'twas ever thus. I mean, what I find about the current situation is just like, how many years have I now heard government ministers from all governments, Labour, Conservative, Coalition, claim that they're going to build more houses? and they're going to build more social houses, and they're going to make sure that houses that are built have, ring-fenced a number of houses that will be affordable. And it just never happens. It never happens in anything like the way that the politicians want. I think they do genuinely want to. And it really just feels like this lever that they pull is not attached to anything. They do their best. They make good speeches, and I think they do try, but for some reason it just doesn't happen. And I don't know if it's a legacy of what happened in the 80s when they sold off the housing stock and then didn't replenish it, if there's a whole load of expertise in housing.
Not only didn't replenish it, but made it almost illegal to replenish it.
Yeah, they did all sorts of stuff like that, which again I think was very, very short-sighted. But I kind of despair, because you know, I'm a beneficiary of this. I'll be honest. I own a nice house. It's worth a reasonable amount of money. And the more this goes on, the more my house is worth. And in 20 years' time, I'll probably be sitting on a nice little nest egg from the value of my house. But when I look at people who are in their 20s and 30s and even 40s, I mean, I'm 43, but there are some people in my cohort who still can't afford to buy houses, who are having to pay God knows how much money. And I worked out, we moved from Berkshire it was just over three years ago. Now, we sold the house 3.5 years ago. And I worked out, we've been in that house for 10 years. And there was a woman who lived three doors up from us who was in a very similar house that would have been worth a similar amount, slightly less because it was slightly smaller, but not much, maybe a few tens of thousands less, but would have been worth a similar amount. And I worked out, since we've moved into that house, when you factored in the interest that we'd paid on our mortgage, not the capital repayments we'd made, because ultimately that comes back to us in the value of the house, but the interest we'd paid, and then worked out how much the house had appreciated, we'd lived in that house effectively rent-free for 10 years. We'd saved £100,000 that we'd have had to have paid in rent because the house had appreciated by a certain amount, and actually the money that we would have spent in rent would have been a lot more than we paid in the interest payments. Now, that's just because we were in the privileged position of being able to buy the house and pay a mortgage. If we hadn't have had enough money to buy the house, we'd have been £100,000 poorer, and we wouldn't have had an asset at the end of it. And it's just crazy. It's absolutely crazy. It really feels like, I remember my grandfather used to say this when he was talking about university, was having to pay for tuition back in like the early 90s when I was having to get a student loan and there weren't full grants and stuff, and he thought that was terrible. He used to describe it as the ladder having been pulled up, and he was furious about it. He was a socialist. He was absolutely furious about it. This feels like that writ large across the entire country. People who now own property are voting for governments who are making sure that the ladder is pulled so far up that the next generation's coming.
Not all people who own property.
Sorry?
Not all of us who own property are voting for government.
No, I understand, but as a cohort, the majority of my cohort now do own property, and the vast majority of the cohorts coming through don't. And the only way they ever will is through inherited wealth, which is entrenching this kind of intergenerational inequality. It's entrenching. Mm. It's what Piketty was writing about. It's getting worse.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I know, Nick, this is something that you're really passionate about and passionate about the Tories changing. I mean, what is it that you want to see Theresa May practically doing that works with, would get through a Tory government, would be voted for by enough of your benches to be passed?
Well, I think there is room to do stuff because, I live in a sort of as strong as you can get conservative area in London, in northwest London. It's on the edge of London. And, very strongly, my own sort of local area, my local ward and local councillor is very strongly conservative. We've got lots of houses in this area. But the people I speak to, if it's the older people, they're worried about their grandkids not being able to get on the housing ladder. The people who are parents, not grandparents, they're living with their children who, are now 25, 26, can't move out of home. So actually, I think there is a realization among the owners of homes, shall we say, that it's gone too far. Now, I think you have to have some sort of mentality change, and that, this idea that a house is an asset it is so pernicious. We're talking about homes here, not assets. If the house price inflation since the early 80s, if you put that onto a chicken, I think a chicken would cost like £50 nowadays. If you put it onto bread, a loaf of bread would cost £10.70 or something nowadays. And but because it's houses, people think, oh, well, I'm getting rich. richer and I'm getting well off. Well, no, that's actually not the case. No. People should have seen when the housing market was overheating, that's not a good thing. We should be creating homes and communities. Now, one of the really, so I am a fan of right to buy, but the caveat is the money that local authorities make from right to buy should be reinvested, a certain portion be forced to reinvest into building new homes. And then obviously, you know, then new homes are built that people can then rent off the council or housing association and then buy in the future. So I think that was one of the major problems. I would also,
question. Because the point of right to buy is a massive discount.
Yeah.
You get a very large discount to own that property. So
yeah.
My concern with that, and I take a very different tack on right to buy. I think right to buy is the worst policy. I mean, it was the best electoral bribe and the worst policy this country has ever had. Mm. It works massively well in terms of that election and we are feeling the impact now. But if you are giving massive discounts, then you have less money to then replenish the stock. I mean, that's just the case. So how would that then not leave you with a diminished amount of stock?
So in terms of, it depends on the discount you give, of course. Also, building houses isn't necessarily the same price as selling houses as well. So it doesn't necessarily equate to if you sell a house for £300,000, it costs £300,000 to replace that house. You are giving people a discount, but also what you're doing is you're acknowledging that they've paid a rent over a long period of time, and you're giving them an opportunity to sort of have a stake in society and move around and be more independent, which I think is a good thing. That does have to be, it has to be done in a certain way where money can be reinvested back into building new homes. And I think local authorities should get back into the business of owning and building and providing homes as well. I mean, housing authorities do fine as well, but taking away local authorities' responsibility to do that on a practical level, I think cause a very negative effect. I mean, one of the other things I would do as well is I would encourage sort of this idea, of plots and people building their own homes and then government basically providing infrastructure for where plots are to encourage smaller builds as well.
See, you just can't help yourself, you Tories. You just love your plots.
We do. We love our home ownership for many reasons. We believe in it also. It's beneficial to us.
I mean, it's interesting what you just said. I don't want to pick you apart too much because I think you're generally in the right track. But it was quite an interesting juxtaposition between we need to stop thinking of housing as assets and owning a home as a stake in society. Mm. And don't you think that those two are slightly contradictory?
No, not at all, because basically, I mean, I don't know if you own your house.
Do you not have a stake in society if you live in social housing?
Of course, you have a stake in society as well. But that moment, so I've only ever owned one house, and it's a very nice house, and I love living here. But the moment when I got the keys and I felt like I owned it, I felt different. I felt really proud, and I think one of the reasons why it was such a popular policy is because people who were living in social housing and state rented accommodation were suddenly they could be a bit prouder and a bit like, we actually own our own property and now we feel more independent, we can sell it, we can move on elsewhere. And I think it does create a sort of a greater sort of connection with society, really, if you are able to own your own house. This is why in the UK, owning a house is part of, it's within our DNA. People say, well, in certain European places, more people rent and we should go down that model. Well, that's not what's in our DNA. We as a society, we sort of, people strive for home ownership, or quite a few people strive for home ownership. So it's not just about the money of owning a house. It's actually about the sort of pride of being a part of society.
I mean, I would argue that you don't need to own a home to be part of society. I own a home because the way society is set up, it makes, I mean, what I pay for my mortgage is what my friends pay for one bedroom. And that's insane. That's disgusting and ridiculous. Whilst I have to live in this system, I'm going to pay that amount for the two-bedroom flat. if I can, but it's awful that I can and others can't. And I think it's really important that we don't tell people in social housing that they don't have a stake in society. It's really important that we make it clear that you're not a lesser person with less pride if you rent or if you're in social housing. And I think I know that's not where you're coming from, but I do think that is quite a pernicious message that is infiltrating at every level. And that is a big part of why there is such a sense of intergenerational unfairness.
Mm. Can I jump in here just to pick up on something that Nick said? Nick, you said that basically you said this is the British way. You know, we want this, you know, our Englishman's home is his castle and blah, blah, blah. I kind of think that feels to me like it's slightly the wrong way around. It feels like the reason, I mean, Emma's just alluded to it, the reason why so many people end up owning property in this country is because structurally, if you don't, you're screwed.
Yeah.
I remember I rented for, it was 12 years in the end, from 1992 until 2004 when I finally bought my first house. And I got absolutely screwed over multiple times. The amount of times I didn't get my deposit back, they insisted on using some really expensive cleaning company to clean the flat. We would get renewal fees every year. We would have to pay more money, even though we were staying and nothing had changed. I got evicted from a flat because I lost my job. And then I knew I was going to find another job. And I stupidly told them I'd been made redundant. And immediately they got really funny, insisted I paid 3 months rent up front. And then after that 3 months, they then evicted me with no reason. Well, actually, the guy said he wanted to move his son in, but I think that was a lie. I think he just thought, oh, this guy's unreliable, we'll get someone else in. No security of tenure. This is one of the reasons I feel so passionate about this, because despite the fact I've now owned my own home for 14 years, I can remember viscerally what it was like to have that kind of insecurity. Now, my cousins used to live in Holland. And I went to Interrailing, traveling around Europe in 1991. And I ended up staying in a flat with a woman who was a friend of my cousin's. And her daughter lived in this beautiful two-bedroom flat. She just had a baby. The baby was, I don't know, 9 months old or something. And she was in the flat. And I remember talking to her and I remember saying, so do you own this flat? And she said, no, I rent it. And I said, okay, are you thinking? And she had a good job as well. I said, are you thinking of buying somewhere soon then, now that you've got a baby? She said, no, why would I want to do that? I can stay here. The rent's really cheap and I can stay here as long as I like. Why would I want to buy anywhere? And to her, it was like a very strange question that I should be asking, would she want to buy somewhere? Whereas in this country, a woman in a similar circumstance who was a professional, who had a child, of course she would be thinking about trying to buy somewhere if she possibly could. Because in this country, you get absolutely shafted if you don't own property long term. So I think unless we can somehow structurally change things, and I appreciate that it is a very, very difficult question. I can't really see it happening in my lifetime, to be honest. But I think people respond to economic incentives. I have done. That's why I own property. That's why Emma owns property. That's probably really, truthfully, why you own it as well. Like, I'm sure there are other aspects as well about having the keys to your own house and Englishman's home is his castle. But ultimately, that house that you've got, and it's a beautiful house in a really nice part of London, I've been there, is going to be worth a lot of money the time you sell it, and you'll have made money out of it. You know, we've got to be honest here. We're all benefiting from it. But it's screwing the generations coming through after us. It's screwing them over.
You know, what we need to think about as we try to change the model is how we have councils build more social housing, more affordable housing, more different types of housing. Now, obviously, that has become more and more complex. You know, as I mentioned at the top of this segment, there was a massive cut in the grant from government for social housing. So councils have had to find money elsewhere. Some of them have done so through some quite controversial methods, not least in Haringey, where there's been this Haringey Development Vehicle, which is a 50-50 public-private partnership between Haringey and Lendlease, which will both regenerate local estates and also, as I understand it, build more housing. There is a lot of controversy around the scheme. Some people are just flat out don't believe that it will deliver any of the things that it has been argued to deliver. And I think particularly with the collapse of Carillion and now the potential collapse of Capita, a lot of the big companies that have worked with local government have screwed local government and central government pretty hard. So there is a really understandable, you know, distrust of that kind of private partnership in these local government things. And this has led in Haringey in particular to some very, very sort of aggressive, from both sides, politics between different bits. I mean, Haringey is almost a one-party state, so it's different bits of the Labour Party. And, you know, lots of headlines about deselections. And today, the leader of Haringey Council has announced that she's not running again as a result of the controversy and as a result of, you know, what she's called, you know, sexist bullying, as a result of that, those decisions that have been made by the council. So councils are in a really difficult bind because there is no money from elsewhere. So they've been forced to go into these sort of private partnerships, bring in a private sector money. And yet councils are not very good at doing that. As we talked about, Nick, you weren't here, but we talked about with Carillion. You know, they are not very good at drawing up contracts that don't screw them over because the people in the private sector have a lot more expertise at that. So how do we, you know, make it, other than lots more central grants, which I think is a part of it, obviously, I think that, I'm a socialist, but apart from that, how do we make sure that councils are able to do this in a way that takes residents with them, as well as takes the current residents with them, as well as delivering, and this is the really difficult part, for the potential future residents who would live in the houses that have not yet been built?
I'll jump in first. That's a massive, massive question, Emma. I'll split it into three parts and answer them all quickly. So the first part is what's happening in Haringey and with momentum and deselections and all this sort of stuff. Now, my first view is in a one party state or one party local authority, which I think is unhealthy, whichever one party it is, then
I mean, I think it's completely one party. There are some Lib Dems
in all essence, it is a one party. There might be a smattering of other parties, but there is only going to be one party in control of Haringey.
And I think there only ever has been since its inception, is my understanding.
Indeed. So for me, it is a one party state, and you know, there are conservative one party states as well. So, you know, it does happen. I think it's unhealthy wherever it happens. You need competition, but
what's your balance like
if you are to. What's that? We have a majority of 20, but it's competitive. You know, we're doing well at the moment, but just very briefly, the way it works in Hillingdon, the North is very strongly Conservative. The South, where John McDonnell was MP in Hayes and Harlington, is very strongly Labour, and it's the centre where the battleground is. And at the moment, we're doing very well, but that could go back the other way. So anyway, but we'll talk about Hillingdon maybe when we come towards local elections next
Fair
time.
Enough.
You know, further on in this podcast, because I've got a lot to say about local politics in London. But if you want to affect change in an area like that, then the way you affect change is through selecting your local candidate. So in a sense, I don't have a problem with campaign groups or people who believe bad decisions being made from actually then taking the sort of the most sort of effective democratic way of resolving that. And so, you know, if a council is making decisions that you strongly disagree with, but you are Labour and they're a Labour councillor, you know they're going to win. Well, actually, then yes, you know, they have to justify themselves to their members. And if they can't justify themselves, so in that box, I think what's happening in Haringey is completely fine. The bit I don't think is obviously completely fine is the NEC of the Labour Party getting involved, because it's a local thing for local people. I don't want to sound, legal gentleman, but the NEC getting involved was absolutely disgraceful and should not have happened, and actually goes against the principles of power to the people and people making decisions that affect themselves. And there is this sort of battle within, you know, ideological versus practical battle and enthusiasm, which can spill over. So, you know, I think that was completely out of order and potentially dangerous as well. But thirdly, going on to how do we resolve the bigger issue, within Hillingdon, we're setting up, a housing company, which is going to be 100% owned by the council. We have an extremely good record on financial management, including contracts. And one of the reasons why is because our leader is an accountant or an ex. I was going to say an ex-accountant, but obviously he is an accountant. But when he first became leader of our borough, essentially the council was broke, and we were really close to essentially being declared bankrupt. So what he did is he basically spent the next 6-7 months going through all the books, learning how local authority financing worked. Learned everything about it, and essentially ever since then he's run the council very tightly and from a financial perspective. Now, having an elected official, the leader, who's accountable to the people, being that involved in how the organization runs, I think makes a massive difference. And I think where councils do suffer is when the elected officials don't get as stuck in, or can't get as stuck in into running the council, and officers go, I'll do that and I won't do that. So so those are the three parts of your point, Emma, that I wanted to answer. So
yeah. Mark, do you have any thoughts on this?
I mean, I haven't really been following too much of the detail about what's happened in Haringey, because obviously I don't live in London. I live a very long way away from London. I mean, my experience of local government is where I used to live, which was in the constituency of Bracknell in Berkshire, where I was involved with the local Lib Dems for a while. And I did try and get elected a couple of times, one quite seriously. One time I was pretty much just a paper candidate, but one time I actually really did go around and knock on doors and spoke to people. It was a by-election, and I did try and get elected. And actually, my message, funny enough, it kind of relates to what Nick was just saying there, which is about not liking one-party states. Oh, and as an aside, Nick, I'm delighted that you've been converted to the cause of proportional representation, which would, of course, resolve that problem. But I was knocking on doors, and actually, my main message was,
I'm going to get a buzzer mark for every time you do that.
That's the first time I've done it in the reboot. I'm allowed to do it once every three podcasts. But I was knocking on the doors, and I was pretty much, my main message was, this council has 31 Tories, 2 Labour and 1 Independent. We need more opposition councillors. And lots of people seem to respond to that message. I lost quite significantly. He got 528 and I got 250 something. Although everyone was saying, like, you did really well. But when I look back at what the guy who'd stood the previous time had got, he got pretty much exactly the same. And apparently he'd never knocked on any doors. So it didn't really seem to make much difference. But I do really think that one party states in any situation is a really, really bad thing. And you know, you see it happen in, you know, the northeast, you know, northern parts of England where Labour run the councils. You see it happening, you did see it happen in Scotland with Labour. I imagine it's probably happening with the SNP in some areas now. I mean, parties just get complacent. I remember standing in one of the voting places and being a teller and talking to some of the other candidates, as I'm sure both of you have done, actually. It's really interesting on election day, because you get to speak to people from other parties and you kind of get it unvarnished. And it was very interesting, actually. The amount of people in the Tories who were just saying, oh, that guy's useless, he's useless, yeah, they just don't bother doing anything, yeah, they just don't bother because they don't have to, because they've just got such a big majority. And, you know, they were just shrugging the shoulders of, what can you do? It's a strong Tory. It's absolutely dreadful.
Yeah.
Absolutely dreadful. And to be fair, again, we were talking earlier on about people responding to incentives. Well, of course, if you've got a seat where you don't really have to fight for the seat and you're just going to get re-elected, and they could stick a blue rosette or a red rosette, or in some areas a yellow rosette on a donkey, and they get elected, why would people bother to do much of a job? Why would they care? No one's really holding them to account. So why would they?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, and that is a problem. And it's a problem of democracy in some ways. I mean, let's not go down the PR wormhole because we've been talking for an hour. But, you know, when enough people in that given area want what they want, you can't tell them they can't have it just because it means that people get complacent. But it does mean that people get complacent. Just slightly to come back on one of your points, Nick, which I agree with the principle about the NEC not getting involved, but as my understanding is, it was actually invited by some of the local councillors. So, which is,
you should have said no. You should have said, buzz off. Go back to deal with the appropriate forum.
I mean, it was by a majority of the local councillors. because there was a decision that was going to be made, which would have tied the hands of the post-May council, which was considered undemocratic by a majority of the councillors, some of whom supported the HDV. And that's why the NEC vote, the NEC is still split. So it wasn't just the Corbynite side saying, ramming something through. It was actually a unanimous vote to do that. So while I completely agree that the NEC should not be getting involved generally, I do understand that there were, and I think it's worth mentioning that there were specific circumstances.
I didn't know about that. I mean, obviously, so...
No, that's fair enough. I mean, there's no reason why anyone would go that far into the weeds normally. it's a distinction worth making. It was a unanimous decision because it wasn't considered to be factional on the NEC. Now, obviously, the way it's been painted has been very different, but that is just worth having an understanding of. But yeah, in general, I absolutely agree with your principle. I think local government should be much, much freer to do things that fit within the general ethos, that don't go against the manifesto of their party. But if you're not going against the manifesto, but doing things that work for your local area, I think that's perfectly fine. I think that should be encouraged.
We go against the Conservative government on things that aren't good locally. So we campaign against HS2, we campaign strongly against a third runway at Heathrow, among other things. So we're a Conservative administration, but we're local. Conservative administration, we're not at all bound by the national party in any way, and we will tell them if we think that they're doing something that isn't good for our area.
I when I was working for a local government think tank, I spoke to a lot of people, a lot of Conservative council leaders who were quite strong against some of the cuts and things like that, and really standing up and making a quite difficult life for themselves. Because it's not much fun being that person, particularly at party conference, for example. It's definitely, and it's always worth having good, strong local champions. And that's important. And, what worries me sometimes is that what you get is good, strong local champions of the type that Mark was talking about when he first responded to this question about social housing, who's championing is basically build nothing here. And that, again, that's what you get if that's who you elect. And it's a big problem because the future population doesn't get a vote. This is, again, one of your interesting quirks of democracy. And on interesting quirks of democracy, I think we might want to leave that now for a week or two even. We will see. Any bets on whether Theresa May will still be in place in 2 weeks, guys?
Definitely.
Yeah, she will.
Definitely. No, there's no doubt about it.
I agree.
I think that every time we say that's definitely what's going to happen, there's no doubt about it, we might come back and do a special podcast.
Well, it'd be very interesting if she goes. As a political geek, I'd be quite happy to see another leadership election because I love that sort of stuff, but I don't think it'd be good for the country.
If there's a leadership election, I'm putting a marker down now. I've got to hand my bloody dissertation in September. I am not having a general election between now and then. I'm just not having it, Theresa May. I am Brenda from Bristol. This is my red line. And on that staunch note, I'd like to thank Mark and Nick. Thank you, guys.
A pleasure, as always.
And thank Kevin Cloud at incompetech.com for our theme tune. My name is Emma Burnell, and this has been a Political Human production. Thank you.